I imagine most of you are familiar with Judge Robbins in that she has been a very active circuit judge in the dependency arena for a while now. She's been a circuit judge since 2002, and she has presented frequently at the summit and in other arenas, and is very well respected and very knowledgeable. And so again, I'm very pleased that we have her here today. She is a circuit judge in the Fifth Circuit, and she's been on the bench, like I said, since 2002. She previously served as a county judge for a couple of years, and before that was in private practice for almost 20 years. So she's done, if I were to read, I would take up most of her time if I were to go through all of her accolades and qualifications. So I'm going to, at this point, hand it over to Judge Robbins. Again, just one more reminder, please put your phone on mute. Please don't put us on hold, and please wait till the end to hang up and hold your questions till the end, because Judge Robbins has indicated that she'd be happy to answer questions at the end of the call. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Judge Robbins.
Okay, thank you. And I will also be happy if any of you have any questions when we're done that you would like to email to me. You are welcome to do that also. And my email address, in the event that you should need it for that purpose, is srobbins@circuit5.org. In the next few minutes during this call, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be talking primarily about shelter proceedings. And I'm going to begin by discussing briefly what the sources are of the law concerning shelter proceedings, and then about what the Department of Children and Family Services is required to do in the context of a shelter proceeding, what the court is required to do in the context of a shelter proceeding, what the order that grants a shelter is required to contain, and then what some best practices are to include and to address in the context of a shelter proceeding. The sources of the law in this area are both federal and state. The federal requirements have been repeated or echoed now under the existing state law, but the federal requirements are still extremely important. They have important consequences for failure to comply. The federal law, which is contained, of course, in ASFA and in the federal regulations that address the requirements of ASFA, the law requires that in the very first order that approves an out-of-home placement for a child, the order must include a finding that continuation of the child in the home from which the child is removed is contrary to the child's welfare. That is a requirement of federal law, which you will now hear echoed in the state law. But what is not in state law and is a requirement of federal law is that failure to include that requirement in the very first order following the removal from the child can't be cured. So, for example, under state law, where we may have a shelter review that's conducted by a dependency court judge after a shelter proceeding is conducted by a non-dependency court judge, it is not sufficient that that be addressed in the shelter review order. It must be in the shelter order. It must include specific findings of fact, and they must be in writing. The federal law also requires findings of fact in that first order concerning reasonable efforts to prevent the removal of the child from the parent's home. In other words, the judge must find what efforts were made by the department to prevent the need for removal and that those efforts were reasonable. All of that has to be in writing. State law is contained primarily in a couple of statutes, in some administrative regulations, and in the Florida Rules of Juvenile Procedure. We're going to be looking primarily today at the requirements of 39402 of Florida statutes, which addresses placement of a child in shelter, the conduct of the shelter hearing itself, and what's required to be contained in the written order. 39401 addresses when a child may be removed by a law enforcement officer or a Department of Children and Family Services agent, which is typically the child protective investigator, and those requirements are very important also. Rule 8305 gives additional requirements about how the shelter hearing itself is supposed to be conducted. A dependency case often starts with the removal of a child and the filing of a shelter petition, but of course it doesn't always happen that way. In some instances, the dependency petition can be filed first and the child will remain in the home of the parent. But even in those situations, a shelter proceeding can follow the initiation of the dependency case. And I'm not telling y'all anything you don't know about this, but just primarily to remind you of that. Whenever, whether the shelter petition starts the case or whether the case is already underway when the shelter occurs, there must be a shelter hearing conducted within 24 hours from removal of the child from the home of the parent. Whenever a child is removed from a parent, additional time limits apply. And these are state and federal, including the requirement that a child may not remain in a shelter placement more than 60 days without having been adjudicated to be dependent. And a child may not remain more than 30 days in a shelter placement after adjudication of dependency without a determination of disposition. When the shelter starts the dependency case, additional time limits begin to run. And those include the deadline for filing the dependency petition, which must be filed within 21 days from the shelter hearing, and that the arraignment hearing must take place within 28 days from the shelter hearing. Both of those time periods can also be shortened on a demand to expedite those proceedings. It's also possible and sometimes happens that the shelter petition is filed prior to removal, and that can also happen whether the shelter proceeding starts the dependency case or whether the dependency case is already underway. There are some differences between the requirements of Section 39401 and the requirements of Section 39402, and those are interesting and educational in many respects. But 39401, for example, requires that whenever a child is removed by a protective investigator or removed by a law enforcement officer and turned over to the department, that the protective investigator, the agent of the Department of Children and Family Services, must review the removal with the DCF attorney in order to determine whether there is probable cause to file a shelter petition. That's what 39401 requires. 39402 is somewhat to the contrary and provides that after a child is removed from a parent's home and continuing until the time when the shelter hearing takes place, the decision to place the child in a shelter or to release the child from a shelter lies exclusively with the protective investigator. Another difference between 39401 and 402 is that 39401 says that judicial review and approval of a decision to take a child into custody is required within 24 hours after a child is placed for all non-relative placements, thus implying that placement with grandma would not require a hearing within 24 hours. 39402 clarifies that a child may not be held in a shelter longer than 24 hours unless an order so directing is entered by the court after a shelter hearing. 39402 requires that for all children in all cases and not merely for those in non-relative placements. The law says in 39402 expressly that a child may not be placed into a shelter prior to a court hearing unless there's probable cause for dependency. Therefore, if that occurs, that is to say, if there's not probable cause for dependency, then the child must be returned to the parent or legal custodian. And that's the clear requirement of 39402. Let me digress for a second to say this about 39. Many, many important terms are defined in the statute. The definition section is 3901. 3901 defines, among many other terms, the term parent. And in the discussion about the definition of a parent, clarifies what the phrase parent or legal custodian means. And you'll see that mentioned many times in the statute, including the portions that we're addressing today. When the phrase parent or legal custodian is used, it refers to the rights or responsibilities of the parent, and only if there is no living parent with intact parental rights to the rights or responsibilities of the legal custodian who has assumed the role of the parent. So in reading all of these statutory provisions, whenever you see the phrase parent or legal custodian, if the child has a living parent whose rights have not been terminated, then that phrase means parent. Shelter is also defined under the statute. Now, I use the term shelter in several different ways, and I'll tell you that I don't mean to be confusing when I do that, but I often use the word shelter to mean the removal of the child from the home and also the hearing itself. I often refer to that as a shelter. But the statute defines shelter to mean the placement with a relative or a non-relative or in a licensed home or facility for the temporary care of a child who is alleged to be or who has been found to be dependent pending court disposition before or after adjudication. So shelter means the out-of-home placement. It doesn't matter whether it's with a relative or in foster care. It does mean that it has to be temporary and not permanent. It doesn't make a difference about whether the child has or has not been adjudicated dependent, but it does refer to a status that exists prior to disposition. Now, those distinctions are more important in other contexts than they are in what we are discussing today, but as lawyers, it's important to remember that. Probable cause is not defined under the statute, but does have a clear meaning under the law, and probable cause is a reasonable ground for suspicion or knowledge of facts and circumstances which would warrant an individual of reasonable caution in believing that an offense had been committed. So reasonable ground means that this is an objective standard and considers how a reasonable individual would review the facts and circumstances. It must be based in law and fact. It's important to understand how probable cause is to be determined. 8305 of the Florida Rules of Juvenile Procedure explains how that's to be done. It requires that the judge conduct an informal hearing and that it be done within the time period required by law. So as you know, that's 24 hours. And at the hearing, the judge is to determine the existence of probable cause to believe the child is dependent and probable cause on the other criteria leading to removal or supporting removal. Note that the probable cause determination is required to be made at the hearing. It is not done in the same way that a judge determines probable cause to find probable cause in support of an arrest warrant in a criminal case, which would be done on the review of the affidavit itself. The rule requires that probable cause is to be determined in a non-adversarial manner and to apply the standard necessary for the arrest warrant. And the standard necessary for the arrest warrant is that which I read to you a minute ago about reasonable ground for suspicion and an individual of reasonable caution in believing the facts that are alleged. At the hearing, the rule 8305 requires that all interested persons, now here it doesn't limit to parties or parents, but says all interested persons shall have the right to be heard and present evidence on the criteria for placement. Now this rule, read together with the statute, has caused many judges and lawyers to conclude that probable cause for dependency at the shelter level is to be determined on the four corners of the shelter petition. And lawyers often argue that at the shelter hearing. I still hear it very often. But that criteria for placement is to be determined based on evidence presented at the shelter hearing. It is not limited to the contents of the petition. Well, the law is actually developed entirely to the contrary of that proposition. The first DCA has clarified in AMT versus State that the parent has a statutory right to contest probable cause at the shelter and that it's reversible error not to allow the parent to present evidence on that issue. The fifth DCA has ruled to the same effect in LMC versus DCF that it is error to deny the request of a parent to present evidence on the issue of probable cause. And then the fifth DCA in another case has come out and said, we don't care what you call it probable cause for dependency, call it probable cause for the need for removal, or probable cause for the filing of a shelter petition, but parents have the right to put on evidence and to argue about all of those issues at the shelter hearing. It is reversible error not to allow that to happen. It's important to realize that probable cause is not an automatic determination. The petition may contain allegations which, if true, would support a finding that the child is dependent. However, the determination of probable cause cannot be done automatically because, as I said before, it's an objective determination. In a case which serves as a good example of that, the Spano versus DCF case, the child made allegations that the mother pushed the child onto the bed, pulled the child's hair, made a motion as if to hit the child, and called the child a bad name. The trial judge found probable cause. The appellate court reversed the shelter and said there wasn't any probable cause. That was not sufficient for probable cause, even though those facts, if they were true, might support a basis for probable cause. The shelter still had to be reversed because in that Spano case, the parents had a long history of an extremely bitter custody battle, and they had been at it for a long time. The appellate court held that a person of reasonable caution would not have believed the facts that were contained in the shelter petition. Now, in a different kind of context, a shelter finding of probable cause was also reversed here, not because the allegations in the petition were not credible, but because the law didn't support it. In ML versus DCF, the mother gave birth to a substance-exposed infant. That is to say, both the mother and the infant tested positive for illegal drugs at the time the infant was born. The mother in that case also had an older child. The department filed a shelter petition alleging dependency as to both of those children. The trial judge found probable cause with respect to both of them and granted the shelter in an order. The appellate court reversed because here the law requires that the infant was properly found on a probable cause basis to be substance exposed, but that does not form a probable cause basis as to the older sibling, merely the fact that the infant tested positive for drugs at birth did not mean that the older sibling was a substance-exposed infant. So it is important to understand what Chapter 39 says about things like substance exposure and what the case law says in determining whether there's probable cause. In a third case, PU versus DCF, the mother was homeless, was living with a friend and then living with another friend, and while living in that transient existence, her child was sexually abused by a neighbor. The trial judge found probable cause both because the sexual abuse occurred and because of the homelessness and instability of the mother. There, the appellate court also reversed and said that does not form the legal basis for determination of probable cause. The point of reciting those cases and those facts to you is to just put you into a situation of being sensitive that probable cause has to be based on law and credible facts, and that it is not an automatic determination in any sense of the word. I can tell you that as a practical matter, oftentimes parents do not contest probable cause. Oftentimes they come to a shelter hearing, will actually tell the judge that they agree or understand that the child needs to live out of home and that they are therefore not contesting probable cause and don't want to be heard on that issue. And that, of course, does change the tenor of the proceeding. In every shelter proceeding, parents are entitled to have notice of that shelter hearing. And that's true even though the hearing comes up very, very quickly after removal. The law requires that the kind of notice that they're entitled to is that which best ensures their actual knowledge of the date, time, and place of the shelter hearing. That standard applies even if the parent is outside of the jurisdiction of the court, which in this context means outside the state of Florida, or if their location is unknown, or in some instances, even if the identity of the parent is unknown. What's required is the best you can do to ensure their actual knowledge. The shelter petition should include a recitation about what notice efforts were made, and then at the shelter hearing, the person giving notice must also advise the court what efforts to give notice were made. Beyond notice of the hearing, parents have the right to receive written notice that they have the opportunity to be heard and to present evidence at the shelter hearing, and that they have the right to counsel. The right to counsel itself applies at the shelter hearing and at every hearing after the shelter under 39013. Every parent is entitled to be legally represented, and this includes the right to court-appointed counsel. There is currently a conflict among the districts about whether appointed counsel is available as a matter of right to a parent about whom no allegations have been made, the parent that I call a non-offending parent. So at this time, whether that person can have appointed counsel depends on where you live. If a parent comes to a shelter hearing and is unrepresented, or even if a parent comes to a shelter hearing and their attorney is present with them at that time, the parent can request to continue the shelter hearing in order to consult with counsel. And if that happens, the judge can continue the shelter hearing for up to 72 hours in order to allow the parents to consult with counsel if the parents request. If that happens, then the children stay in the placement that the department has made of them until the shelter hearing takes place. Now, if the shelter petition is filed prior to the hearing and if the shelter petition is filed prior to the removal of the child from the parent, the department can still remove the child after this occurs if there's an emergency or if the child's situation requires removal. But if that happens, then you have to still comply with the remainder of the statute. Aside from advising the parent of the right to counsel and appointing counsel for the parent beginning at shelter, a party, now here this is not just a parent, but any party to a case, who is identified as having a mental illness or a developmental disability must be informed by the court of the availability of advocacy services through the department or the Association of Retarded Citizens or some other mental health or advocacy group, and they have to be encouraged to seek those services. So a best practice would require that right at the beginning, when the inquiry is made about the right to counsel and there's an inquiry about whether the person is treated psychiatrically or has any mental health diagnosis, once that's ascertained, this advice should be given at that time. The shelter judge is required at the shelter hearing to appoint a guardian ad litem. The law says unless such representation is unnecessary. Well, when would it be unnecessary? The general law now indicates that if you have a parent who is not abused, abandoned, or neglected as a child, that such a parent can protect the child's best interest. So if a child is placed with a non-offending parent after a shelter hearing, in that circumstance, representation by a guardian ad litem might be unnecessary. However, there's not a prohibition against appointing a guardian ad litem even then. The statute is quite repetitive in its insistence that parents must be advised of their right to counsel. That information must be afforded to a parent at the shelter and at every subsequent hearing if their parent is unrepresented. The statute actually requires the judge to tell the parent that they have the right to be represented by counsel at shelter and at each subsequent hearing. And then the order should reflect that the court told the parent at the shelter that they have the right to be represented by counsel at the shelter and at each subsequent hearing. Then that must be renewed at each subsequent hearing. The judge is required to obtain the permanent mailing address from each party and advise the party that that address will be considered for notice purposes until it's changed in writing. That should be done at the shelter hearing. And that should also be included in the written order from that hearing. Let me digress for a moment to say that a party to a dependency case is the department, the petitioner, the parent or parents, the child or children, and the guardian ad litem. In a shelter proceeding, the department and the petitioner are always the same party. In other kinds of cases, there may be the department and a different petitioner. Who a party is, the identity of who the parties are is defined by statute. Who a parent is also defined by statute. It's important from the beginning of the case that the judge identify who the parties are who are present, and that's going to include figuring out who the parents are, and that should be done beginning at the shelter proceeding. Now, who a mom is in a case like this is usually pretty clear, although is one of the who a parent is one of the terms that's defined by statute. The statute says that the mother is the person who gives birth to a child. Now, the definition of a father is also included, but it's a little bit harder. The father is a man whose consent to the adoption of the child would be required under 63062(1). And who that is not, as we're sometimes told, incapable of determination. It's actually somewhat clear from the statute that a father's consent under 63062 is required if the child was conceived or born while the father was married to the mother, if the minor is his by adoption, if he's been adjudicated by the court to be the child's father, by the date that a petition is filed for termination of parental rights, or if he has filed an affidavit of paternity under the statute that allows him to be placed on the child's birth certificate, by the date a petition is filed for termination of his parental rights, or if he's an unmarried biological father and has taken the steps that are necessary to preserve his rights. And in a nutshell, those are registration with a putative father registry and providing support for the child when that's required and establishing and maintaining a relationship with the child when in the manner that's described in Chapter 63. So that's who the parents are. And at the shelter hearing, in the process of identifying parties, the court is required to conduct a paternity inquiry, preferably of the mom, if she's present, but it can be done, according to the statute, of someone else who's present who has knowledge. This information can also be provided by affidavit, and that would oftentimes speed up the process. But the inquiry under 39503 is similar to, but not exactly the same, as that list of individuals that is identified under Chapter 63. The inquiry requires the court to ask whether the mother was married at the time the child was conceived or born, whether she cohabited with a man at the probable time of conception, whether she received payments or promises of support with respect to the child because of her pregnancy from a man who claims to be the father, whether the mother named any man as the father on the birth certificate or in connection with applying for or receiving public assistance, or whether any man has acknowledged or claimed paternity since conception. If a person is identified pursuant to that inquiry, then the law requires that that person have an opportunity to become a party to the case, and that's done by filing an affidavit of parenthood. And the deadline for filing it is the date of the adjudicatory hearing in the termination of parental rights case. So some of the terminology is different than that which is required under Chapter 63, and the time limits are different. However, we're bound by Chapter 39, and that's what the law is under Chapter 39. We identify the parties in that manner. The judge is required to find at shelter that placement in a shelter is necessary and that placement is in the child's best interest. Under the statute, the judge is required to contain in the written order granting shelter that continuation in the home is contrary to the child's welfare because there's a substantial and immediate danger that can't be mitigated by the provision of appropriate services. Now, the continuation in the home is contrary to the child's welfare. It's the same requirement that we heard under federal law, and the rest of this clarifies that. There is a substantial and immediate danger to the child that can't be mitigated by services. If it can be mitigated by services, then we're required to mitigate it. The order must find that there's probable cause to find that the child is dependent, or that the judge needs additional time in order to obtain and review additional documents in order to appropriately determine the risk to the child. The additional time that can be allowed in this statute is, again, 72 hours. The written order granting the shelter must make findings that the department has made reasonable efforts to prevent the need for removal, just like the federal statute requires. But here we're required to find that reasonable efforts have been made or that the department is deemed to have made reasonable efforts. And the word deemed here should be said to mean that they're excused. So when are reasonable efforts excused under the statute? They're excused when there's an emergency or when the home presents a substantial and immediate danger which can't be mitigated by preventive services, or when the child can't safely remain at home either because there's no preventive services or even with available services, the child's health and safety can't be ensured. Now, I, for one, don't know what the difference is between those two. I understand what an emergency is, but between those two, I do not know the exact difference. They are very, very similar in application. There is a fourth reason that reasonable efforts can be excused, and that's when a parent has committed an act that falls under Section 39-806-1F-I for expedited termination of parental rights. Now, note here that 39-402 refers to 39-806-1 and the grounds for expedited termination of parental rights, but it includes less than all of those grounds. The grounds for termination of parental rights in general are listed in 39-806-1. 39-806 subparagraph 2 says that efforts to preserve or reunify are not required if any of the grounds under 39-806-1E through L are proven. So those are the grounds for expedited termination of parental rights, if you will, although it is hard to imagine how you could expedite and comply with 39-806-1E. So 39-402 probably omitted E for that reason, because it does require services and compliance with a case plan and so on. But 39402 omitted J through L only because 39806(1) has been amended to add those additional grounds since 39402 was amended last. But in any event, 39402 says that reasonable efforts are deemed if a parent committed an act under 39806(1)(f) through I and doesn't include the grounds J through L. I could add that if the parent did commit an act under J through L, then efforts would probably be deemed under one of these other situations anyway. But as an academician, I can't avoid telling you that that's what the statute says. The shelter order is required specifically to include some things that the judge is required to tell people. It's required to tell the parents that it is important to appear and participate at every hearing and to give them the date, time, and place of the next hearing. In the next hearing, it's required to include a review of the shelter placement. Note that this statute requires that same information be given to the relatives who are providing care. So obviously best practices is going to require that those relatives receive notice and that they're at the shelter hearing. The order again is required to tell the parents about their right to counsel, and the order is required to tell relatives. Now let me clarify. The order is required to say that the judge told the relatives, implying again that they're there at the hearing, that they have the right to attend all subsequent hearings and to submit reports to the court and to speak to the court regarding the child if they so desire. So the statute requires, and best practices certainly require, that those relatives be present at the hearing and certainly that they receive a copy of the shelter order, because this is provided for their benefit. That's the relatives who are providing out-of-home care for a child. Now, someone should probably also explain to them that they won't have the ability to speak to the court regarding the child whenever they want to, that there may be some parameters that apply to that, but this is what the statute specifically says. The department is required to tell the court in the shelter petition and at the shelter hearing what its recommendation is about scheduled contact between the child and the parents. And the term visitation is what's used under Chapter 39 to describe that contact. The court is required to order visitation unless there's a clear and convincing showing that visitation is not in the child's best interest. So if you are wanting the parent not to have visitation, that there has to be a clear and convincing showing at the shelter hearing. The rules of evidence don't apply at these hearings, and that's why this statute doesn't say clear and convincing evidence, but you have to give the judge something in order to meet this requirement. But note that if Section 390139 of Florida statutes applies, then you get exactly the opposite result. 390139, of course, is the Keeping Children Safe Act. And if the Keeping Children Safe Act applies to the parent, then that statute imposes a rebuttable presumption that contact between that parent and the child is that there's a presumption of harm as a result of that contact. So once the presumption arises under 390139, then the court is required not to order visitation for that parent. It requires that a guardian ad litem be appointed for the child who has special training in the dynamics of child sexual abuse, and then the burden to prove non-detriment is on the parent seeking the visitation. So none of this is going to happen at the shelter hearing. It's going to happen at a later date once the parent requests the hearing and the guardian has been appointed and so on. The law requires that visitation between a parent and a child begin within 72 hours unless the department provides justification. Now, for all of these things, including the finding of justification, the court should make written findings. And keep in mind, please, in asking your court to make written findings, the requirement that that non-visitation requires clear and convincing showing that visitation is not in the child's best interest, and of course the finding under the Keeping Children Safe Act. The court is required to direct the parents to provide financial information within 28 days for purposes of child support. The statute says that if the child is possessed of a guardianship estate, then the guardianship estate may in some situations be required to support the child during a shelter stay. But keep in mind that if the child has a parent whose rights have not been terminated, then even if the child is possessed of a guardianship estate, the parent is almost invariably going to be required to pay financial support, and thus we need the financial information. The court is required to ask the parents to provide consent and to produce information or make records available concerning the child's medical and educational records. And the court can also direct that medical and educational records be released in the absence of a consent or if a parent unreasonably withholds consent. The court also has the power at shelter to appoint a surrogate for a child who has a disability. The outside of 39402 is the directions concerning a child who is receiving psychotropic medications, but if the child is removed from the home and is receiving prescribed psychotropic medications at the time of removal, if the department is unable immediately to obtain parental authorization to continue providing the medication, the department has the power under the psychotropic medication statute, which is 39407, to continue to provide the medications provided that they have the original medications and the medication is in the original container. The court can authorize the department to continue to provide those medications up until the time of the arraignment hearing. Parental consent should be obtained at the shelter if the parent, certainly the judge needs to ask at the shelter hearing about parental consent. But even absent parental consent, if it can't be obtained or if it's unreasonably withheld for a short period of time, the court can order the medications to continue to be provided. But the child has to be evaluated then by a physician, and there has to be compliance with 39407 after that date. Keep in mind that what I just said about psychotropic medications also applies for any other kinds of medications that the child is on. The judge should obtain consent from the parents to continue to administer other kinds of medications if they're prescribed for the child, and they can also be continued to be administered on those same terms if appropriate. But the child is going to be evaluated physically, and medications can be updated at that time and so on. In any event, consent from a parent should be inquired about at the shelter, and then the results of that request for consent should be contained in the shelter order. The shelter order is specifically required to contain another finding about reasonable efforts, and that is the court is required to make a written determination about what specific services, if available, could eliminate the need for continued removal from the home and the date by which those services are expected to become available. Now, this necessarily means that your judge is going to have to be aware of and familiar with available services. If your judge isn't going to be likely to be able to fulfill the requirement, then the department needs to provide a person with knowledge at the shelter hearing to provide that information. The CPI is unlikely to be able to provide it, although sometimes they are aware of what kind of services may be able to prevent the need for removal. In other words, the services that are provided before that shelter removal takes place. But if those services fail, then sometimes the CPI is somewhat lost about what to be ordered in the future to eliminate the need for an ongoing removal. But the judge is still required to address that at the shelter. So please be sure that a person, a knowledgeable person, is in the courtroom at shelter to provide that information. And specific services need to be identified as well as times of availability. The law requires that if the services are not available, there also has to be a written determination about why, a written explanation about why the services are not available for the child. Then at the end of the hearing, the department is required by the statute to provide referral information to the parents there and then. So that's another reason to have a person available there at the hearing to provide both the information that the judge needs about available services and to provide the referral information to the parents. The statute expressly provides that the parent can participate in those services beginning right then, and that's not considered to be an admission or an acknowledgement of any kind about the allegations in the shelter petition. The judge is required to tell the parties, and including the parents, about the next scheduled hearing date to review the shelter placement. That hearing date to review the shelter placement should be done in connection with the arraignment hearing. It must be done not later than 30 days from the shelter, and you can do it sooner, and you can do more than one. You could review the shelter placement every day, in fact, if you had time for it, and sometimes frequent hearings are appropriate if you're trying to eliminate some particular problem and get the child back home, for example. The court is required at the shelter to have the parents identify relatives who may be considered for placement, and to advise the parent that they have a continuing duty to keep the court and the department informed of who the relatives are who may be considered for placement. A best practice here is to have the parent identify not only those relatives that the parent believes are appropriate for placement, but to identify all of the relatives, because sometimes the relatives are the best source of identifying other relatives and persons who are available for placement. The court is required to tell the parents the following advice. The court shall advise the parents that if the parents fail to substantially comply with a case plan, their parental rights may be terminated and the child's out-of-home placement may become permanent. That should be explained to the parents out loud at the shelter hearing if they're present, and it should be included in the written order. It is required by law. There are some other things that are wonderful additions or are helpful practices that can be done at shelter hearings. One of the main ones that attorneys can do that is of great benefit is to use a checklist to make sure that all of these numerous requirements are met. Sometimes a small thing is overlooked, and sometimes it's extremely important. So if you have a good checklist, you can follow along. Even the guardian ad litem attorney, who doesn't have a specific job to do at shelter, is a wonderful person if you're there to follow along and make sure that these things are done. I know sometimes the attorney will very politely stand up in my courtroom and say, at the appropriate time, will the court please inquire of the parent's permanent address for mailing, by which they mean, judge, you forgot to ask about the address. But by whatever means available to you, please be sure that all of these issues, all of the things that are required by the statute to be done, are all done. I'm suggesting that the paternity inquiry under 39503 should be conducted at the shelter as a matter of best practice, but also that there should be a written order concerning the results of the paternity inquiry so that you don't have to do it over and over again, so that it's preserved for the file. That should be placed in a file. It's important from the beginning of the case and therefore from shelter on that we address concurrent case planning. So identifying relatives is an important first step in concurrent case planning, but also ordering home studies for possible relatives, either for visitation or for possible placement, ICPC compliance from the earliest possible date, obtaining substance abuse evaluations for parents or for persons who are seeking custodial placement of a child beginning at the shelter. All of those are important steps toward concurrent case planning, and you can probably think of a dozen others. It's very crucially important, beginning at shelter, to make sure that the child service needs are identified and ordered or directed So, for example, a child who needs counseling should be referred to counseling from the beginning of the case. A child who comes into custody needing dental work should be afforded an opportunity to have dental work. A child who has spent his whole life needing a neurological examination but has never had one, let's see what we can do to get the child service needs met. Redirecting child support is an important early step in these proceedings. We can't order child support at shelter, but if you have an existing child support order, let's say, for example, the father has been ordered to pay child support for the mother, and as a result of the shelter proceeding, the child has been removed from the mother's care and placed with a grandparent, the father's support obligation, having already been established, can be redirected to the grandparent. And under unified family court principles, that may be able to be done by your dependency court judge. But in any event, take the steps necessary to get that child support redirected. By the same token, if the father has been ordered to pay child support to the mother, and as a result of the shelter, the child is removed from the mother and placed with the father, child support can be suspended at that time. If the child is of an appropriate age and if the circumstances are otherwise appropriate and the child has an interest in participating in the proceedings, then every effort should be made from the very beginning of the case to have the child participate in the proceedings. And I am not suggesting that children should come to shelter hearings, because generally speaking, they've been through enough on that day. But at future hearings, certainly if the child wants to come, then every effort should be made to accommodate that desire. But besides that, children should also be included in receiving copies and notices unless it is inappropriate to provide that information. And then lastly, because the time limits and deadlines in these cases are so important, we must all work together to make sure that the deadlines and time limits are met. Now, if at this time any of you have any questions that you want to pose telephonically, I will be happy to entertain those.
Judge Robbins?
Yes, sir.
This is Brad Bobbitt. I have a question, and it has a general application. It's a fact pattern that occurs across the circuit and probably across the state. I see it all the time. And it's kind of a best practices issue. The fact pattern is very broad. It's the case where you're trying to conduct your shelter and you've done your paternity inquiry with respect to the mother, and you look up and you see a young man standing there. He's trying to get your attention. He is the person that just identified as the prospective father. What is the best practice for us as attorneys and the court as the judge to treat him at that point? What do we do with him?
Well, the last time I tried to engage in a dialogue on that particular topic, it almost broke out into warfare, but I can tell you what the statute says, and I can tell you what I do, and I cannot tell you that what I do is best practice. But the statute requires that the person be given an opportunity to become a party, and it tells them what they have to do. They have to complete an affidavit of parenthood. If they complete it and by the deadline, and the deadline is the termination of parental rights adjudicatory, then they're treated as a parent in this Chapter 39 case, which means they're entitled to appointment of counsel, unless the mother disagrees that they should be treated as a parent. And if that happens, then they can't be treated as a parent until somebody initiates and completes proceedings under Chapter 742. In the meantime, they're a prospective parent, and that means they receive notice only. But let's say, for example, they do promptly execute a sworn affidavit of parenthood, and let's say there are no legal impediments to establishment of parenthood, then at that point, party to the case, they're entitled to court-appointed counsel, and they're treated exactly the same way as any other parent. Now, I myself, and I'm saying this in front of many, many lawyers, and I realize there's no statutory authority for it. I enter a final judgment of paternity on those facts and have it recorded in the public records and reside in the final judgment that it's going to be recorded notwithstanding confidentiality requirements. And the reason that I do that is that I can then provide a copy to the Department of Revenue, and that can form the basis for an establishment of child support without further proceedings in that arena and so on.
It's treated like an uncontested paternity determination, basically.
Exactly.
But what? How about those fact patterns when the gentleman says, "Well, you know, I just don't know. I mean, we were together, but I don't know if I'm the father."
You know what? I don't. This is one of the areas where there's a great deal of differences of opinion, and I can't say who's right and who's wrong. But the statute just requires what I've already read out loud, and
okay.
So what I do, but there is under the circumstances that allow the court to order an examination or an evaluation of a person under Chapter 39, you can order DNA testing. It's just that it's difficult to get it paid for and that kind of thing. If you're in an area where that's not an issue, then you can go right ahead and order that. There's no Chapter 39 doesn't say what happens if there is a positive result from DNA. So you don't actually get anywhere by the DNA test results. But sometimes once a person understands that he's the biological father, he may then go ahead and sign that affidavit of parenthood and be happy to have paternity established for him.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there another question?
Well, if there's no more questions, we'll go ahead and wrap up this training. Thank you very much. And I wanted to add, too, we do have a shelter checklist that we use, and I'm going to go ahead and update it with some of the judge's recommendations and put it on the website so that you can put that in your trial notebook and take it to court with you.
If I may add that the dependency court improvement panel for the state has also developed a checklist which is called a bench card.
Okay.
I can provide that to you. You might want to also disseminate that to your people because it's quite thorough and includes a number of very good practices. It you see, when you look at it, does require DNA testing on the facts that Mr. Bobbitt was asking about. But for the benefit that it may have to you all, I'll be happy to provide that.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for your training today.
Okay, and if any of you do want to ask a question that you didn't want to ask out loud, you're welcome to email me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.